Hello and welcome back to Even More News, the first and only news podcast. My name is Katie Stoll.
That's so true, Katie Stoll. That is your name. That is what we have here podcast-wise. My name's different. It's Cody Johnston.
Hey, Cody Johnston. Welcome back to your own show. And joining us today for the first time, climate scientist, founder of the Climate Ad Project, author of the book Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution, Peter Kalmus. Hey, Peter.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We're thrilled to have you on. You're like the real deal smart guy, and we've got questions.
Somebody who knows what they're talking about.
Or other now, broad now I'm topics.
I'm getting more nervous now.
Oh, don't be.
No pressure. Just be right about everything.
Just be right.
Exactly.
Fact check yourself as you go. This is live. No editing.
There's
no backseas.
There's so much data to just ingest into my brain. It's insane. Like just reading papers and IPCC reports. So yeah, I try to keep it straight, but there's only so much one person can get in there.
I'm curious about some of that. First, I need to call out what holiday it is. December 4th, National Dice Day. I'm not going to lie. I read this as National Nice Day until right this moment, and I'm seeing that it's Dice Day, and I'm wishing I hadn't chose that one. But happy National Dice Day, dice heads.
I think we could all use a National Nice Day more.
I know. Can't we just... It's Dice Day, but let's make it Nice Day. Let's just
National
have a nice
be
day.
Be Nice Day is October 5th. Can't do it anymore.
Well, like 2 months ago. We blew right past that. I don't want you to be nice. I just want things to be nice. Yeah, you don't have to be nice. Peter, you were just talking about keeping all of that information in your head, and that made me go, yes, I struggle with that. And I'm sure with your job and all of the different data that you are ingesting, that it can be a little overwhelming, especially when we understand the dire stakes of you know, the climate crisis.
You know, it's changing so fast, too. So that adds another dimension.
Yeah.
And then, you're right. There's this really intense kind of emotional component, even though, you know, we're doing scientists, but we're human, and it can be challenging to, you know, keep up with the rate of information and also the sort of implications of the information for anyone who enjoys living on this planet, I guess.
Yeah.
Most people, hopefully.
Hopefully. I mean, you'd think it'd be one thing we could unify over.
You'd think,
and yet,
but...
And yet.
Yeah, I talk a lot on the show about my climate anxiety. And I mean, it's every day. Every day I have some moment of panic or at least a thought of anguish. You know, how long will this last? I go for my walk and I try to remind myself, enjoy this, enjoy every second of that I get to have in this neighborhood, in this life, because I don't know what's going to happen next or how this is going to affect us. And just feeling overwhelmed with not knowing what to do. And that's why we're really grateful to have you on here so you can talk to us about some of this. And I bet it'll be depressing, but maybe maybe not.
Maybe it's sort of a mixture. I don't know. I mean,
I think that's the reality.
That's what it always is, really. It's depressing. And they're like, but we could do this, or but on the bright side, here's this tiny little piece.
You know, I think there's something about like having a real conversation about it and not just like this sort of sugarcoated conversation that somehow like maybe not, it maybe takes away some of the depression, because otherwise you might just be like sitting there and feeling like you're kind of more alone with these darker thoughts, you know? So
yeah.
I don't know, like something about really talking about it with other people can help, I think.
Yeah. And I imagine for you, it's a fine line to walk. I mean, for all of us. But, you know, I hear interviews or podcasts or read things from climate scientists. And some people take the path of, we don't want you to freak out and get despondent. We don't want you to feel like there's no hope. I get that. But there's also the dire reality of the situation that we face. And so there is a little bit of a dance between motivating people with the facts and having them not shut down because I guess we can't handle the truth. I don't know. You know, does that make sense?
It does. And I don't want people to feel despondent either. But at the same time, you know, as a scientist and just someone who really values the truth, like, it's abhorrent to me to imagine not just saying like exactly what I thought was closest to the truth. And, you know, it's difficult too, because we're not always just talking about factual truth. We can talk about rates of sea level rise, or we can talk about, you know, increases in frequency and intensity of heat waves that are coming. But then, like, what's the emotional truth behind those as well, too, right? Like, I don't want to try to sugarcoat that either. But, you know, I think there's, you can go back and forth between, you know, seeing the really dark, depressing side of this, and then imagining something that I hope can still, and there's nothing physically that prevents it from happening. I hope it's still a possibility and something that can really happen. A humanity, a human species, a global society, if you will, that decides, you know, hey, this is not okay what the fossil fuel industry is doing. Hey, this is a beautiful planet and there's still a ton left to save on here. And we're going to take all of these obvious steps that we need to take, even if it means a little bit of sacrifice. And we're going to do the things that we know we need to do to kind of reharmonize with the rest of life on this planet and have like a beautiful future going forward centuries and millennia into the future on Earth. And the sense of solidarity and relief and joy that we would all feel if that were to happen. Like, that's the other side of things. And that's part of why I think it's such a mistake for people to sugarcoat, because I'm not an expert in sociology or psychology, but I am a human and I've lived with my own thoughts and with my loved ones and my friends for a long time. And, you know, there is a purpose to fear, and there's even a purpose to panic. And that's to give you a kick in the ass when you need to make a change, for your own safety, for your own happiness, right? For your own best possible future. And I think as a species, that's what we're facing right now. And I think that it's not, you know, when people say, you know, maybe we should be panicking about this, I don't take that in a negative way. I take it as like an aha, like wake up moment, like holy shit, the way we've been doing things for the last couple of hundred years have gotten us to this point. And it's really comfortable to keep doing things the same way. It's very hard to, we're a species with a lot of inertia for all of, you know, kind of the way we pat ourselves on the back and about our technological progress and everything. But socially and culturally, there's a lot of inertia in our species. Yeah. And this is a moment where we have to kind of change and come out of that inertia and change directions culturally and socially in an incredibly short amount of time, right? So if people say like, oh, it's not that bad, you know, oh, we're on track, like, oh, we just need like a little bit more technology to get out of this. And your average person who's not a climate scientist and who's very understandably trying to kind of like keep some of this scary stuff out of their brain because they got a million other things to think about and do, and they don't want to have to worry about the planet burning up on top of everything else. So when they hear that from an expert that maybe they don't have to do anything, they don't have to make any changes, they don't have to worry about things, what does that mean when you have 99% of experts, for example, kind of messaging that because they've decided it's more effective not to scare people? Well, maybe that's part of why there's a lot of reasons why we're here and we've basically not taken nearly enough action as a species. And the lies from the fossil fuel industry, probably the biggest of all, but maybe also this kind of misguided sense that we can change society faster by sugarcoating things, right? I think that's a mistake personally.
Yeah.
And again, my intention is to make change as fast as possible and to save as many lives as possible and to save as many of the beautiful places on this planet and other species as possible. So that's where my intention is. But I, yeah. Does that make
sense?
Well,
you can't make those changes if we're not boldly facing the truth of the situation.
Exactly.
You know, I was going to get to this a little later, but this seems like a good point to talk about. I'll bring up this article that you recently put out, you know, forget plans to lower emissions by 2050. This is deadly procrastination, you know, and you talk a little bit about what you were just saying, you know, in this whole idea that, you know, direct capture and or desalinization, these technologies that exist, and like a lot of people point to it as something that we can count on for reducing emissions and solving our problems. And I want to believe that. I do look at, like, this is maybe foolish, but like, yeah, you see Elon Musk go into space building spaceships, and they've got all these problems here. And I know that there's a lot of different things that stop that from becoming a viable path forward for us, certain things. But like, if there was enough investment, could that possibly be something that we can rely on? But then again, you say that, and then people start to take away their personal responsibility and look to that as the big miracle that will save us. And that seems dangerous. That seems wrong.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not personal responsibility in terms of kind of living a carbon, like a low carbon life, although that's a very good thing to do. But it's more like personal responsibility to be like, how much can we swear on this show, by the way?
As much as you want. Fucking letter rip.
Yeah, it's the personal responsibility I think we all have at this point to say, holy fuck, everyone wake the fuck up. This planet is on fire. We have to switch into emergency mode. That's what I want to happen. I want to see everyone be like, so it's hard, as a scientist, it's hard because I see this emergency that's kind of unfolding over the course of years and decades. And I you know, anyone who reads the papers, and it takes some effort, reads the IPCC reports, they can peer ahead into what's coming in, you know, 2030s, what's coming in the 2040s, what's coming beyond the 2040s, if we stay on this course. And it's genuinely terrifying. You know, we've all heard we've heard all of the catastrophes that are lining up to hit global society so many times, I think, that we tend to roll our eyes and not, and maybe discount that this is stuff that's really going to happen. But if you stop and look at the intersecting stresses, they're going to start to hit our surprisingly non-resilient global systems in the coming decades, right? There's so many of them, and they overlap in so many ways. And I'm talking about things like water systems and food systems and infrastructure systems. And you can even start getting into, you know, like things like media systems that can lead to, you know, authoritarian crackdowns and walls being put up on borders to keep people from nations that are overheating to move, you know, and then the geopolitics.
It's happening everywhere.
It is.
I mean, and Biden just reinstated the Remain in Mexico, but expanded it. You know, this is all about refugees and people coming here and needing a place to go, and they can't.
Look, we all love supporting the post office, but sometimes there's just too much to do if you've got a lot of mail to ship or, for some reason, a bulk order of fish face figurines. And that's where Stamps.com comes in. Think of it like using the stairs versus the elevator. The stairs are great for a few floors, sure, but you're not going to walk up 30 flights a day, am I right? And again, they save you so much time and money, not to mention that if you sign up with promo code MORENEWS, you will get a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click at the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code MORENEWS. But don't steal the fish face idea, because that's Katie's idea. You got it?
I get the sense that the public doesn't understand what it means for something to be trending in a physical sense, like, which means that like every year you're going up one more stair step. So it's not a new normal. It's like all this craziness from 2021 is going to get stronger on average in 2022, and then stronger on average in 2023. And then new craziness is going to happen. We're going to start seeing, you know, crop failures, for example, which are going to make crazy food prices. We're going to see. So I don't, we could talk about collapse, I guess. Because I don't think it's talked about enough. And you say that word, and it's sort of like a dirty word. And I think that it hasn't been well defined, because it doesn't mean that, you know, one day you wake up and it's like the road out there and it's like post-apocalyptic. It's a slow thing that I think we're already living through. Like when you get a heat dome, when you get crazy rains that like isolate Vancouver from the rest of Canada, that's sort of how collapse unfolds over many years and many decades. Food gets more expensive. You start seeing climate-driven famines emerging in certain countries. You start seeing wars maybe over basic resources.
Very soon.
You know, like water, for example. I'm just speculating. But so far we haven't even I think there's just such a lack of thought that's gone into how this might unfold. And again, it's like I don't do this to scare people. I it's more just like, gosh, in some sense, like, aren't you curious? And don't you want to kind of know what's coming so that you can make the best possible decisions today, whether it's for your own life, whether it's for your city, if you're like a city council person, whether it's for your state, whether it's for your nation? Like, how do we deal with this? What's the path out of this? And if you don't even accept that the possibility that, you know, we might not have commercial aviation and we might not even have a robust food system, then it makes it that much harder to switch into what I call emergency mode, which is what I think has to happen. Because again, like, there's this lag. I'm looking at the 2040s, maybe. Things are starting to happen faster than we expected, but you know, I'm looking ahead a little bit and seeing this really scary stuff. But at the same time, today, it's a beautiful day outside and everything's working. You can go to the supermarket, the shelves are full. So how do you span that sort of that lag, that temporal gap? You have to somehow communicate that the disasters that, and I, 15 years ago, I was trying to do this before there were heat domes and flash floods that were killing people in their apartments in New York. And it was like, no go. No one wanted to hear about it. At least now that we're starting to see some of these disasters in real time, it's not an academic exercise. It's not a scientific exercise anymore. It's stuff that's really happening to real people, people in the global north too, right? Because when these kinds of disasters have been happening in the global south for quite a bit, they're more sensitive to climate chaos than we are in the global north. Yeah. But somehow, you know, it's the mindset is it happening in a place like where I live? Is it happening to people that seem like me, right?
So I don't see it in my front yard, so it's not happening. Right. I can disconnect.
Or it's not today. Right. Or things are happening that, like you were talking about, like 15 years ago, you're saying this is going to happen, this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Not worried about it. Now that it's happening, now it's all like we're in the stage of that sort of normalization where, okay, well, that's happening now. We can deal with that. And so you don't do anything about the things that will happen in 10 or 15 or 20 years.
Right.
And we're sort of always honestly, in this limbo of inaction because of how, like, for like emergency mode you're talking about to really kick in, like we're incapable of really planning ahead or seeing that or caring about something that's far ahead. So it has to be like, oh no, this happened. Now it's an emergency. And that's just not the situation.
That's not how we can handle
this.
It's
not going to happen that way. Where it's like
by
suddenly,
the time you're
everywhere,
seeing it,
climate change is apparent to everybody suddenly. And sometimes it just feels like that's what has to happen in order for that mode to actually kick in.
So we need to do it. You're right. And if there's like, you know, if it's a World War II type situation and Pearl Harbor gets bombed, then suddenly everyone's in emergency mode. That's the way the human brain works. So we need a different kind of transition this time. This time it's got to be sort of, it's got to come through cultural knowledge, basically, right? So the scientific knowledge and the like climate disasters that we're starting to see at a low level today, which are like little previews
which aren't
of
even low.
The future. Well, they're low compared to what's coming. But That's what I mean by the trends. We need to somehow use that to create the emergency mode response that we need to save as much as we can and to make the best possible future, not even just for our kids anymore, but for ourselves. Like if you're a middle-aged, if you're under the age of 60, you should care very much I mean, if you're empathic and you're over the age of 60, you should still care very much. But if you have more than, you know, say 10 years on this planet, I think you're going to be very affected, and you're going to be very, you would much prefer a society switching into emergency mode now than a society not switching into emergency mode, because your life in the near future is going to be so much better if we do switch into emergency mode. I should probably define what that means.
Yeah.
What it basically means is that society and policymakers and world leaders actually start, you could say, I don't know if it's the right word, but targeting the fossil fuel industry, like directly saying
that is the right term. Yes, right. Exactly.
Saying like, okay, so we're on the verge of basically losing a beautifully habitable planet. The reason for it is that we're burning way, way too much fossil fuels. We're doing this because we have an industry that's still getting subsidized at the rate of $11 million a minute, and is, you know, has been lying for decades systemically. You know, ExxonMobil in 1990 basically made a bullet point presentation and gave it to all the other oil majors in the world, saying exactly how to create uncertainty and doubt and, you know, legislation at the state, local, and national levels to prevent action on climate change, et cetera, right? So given all of that, given that we're about to lose everything, and the cause, the main cause, is the fossil fuel industry, we need to rapidly ramp down that industry over a course of, you know, maybe 10 years, a course of years and not decades, very rapidly. What does that mean? How can we do that in a just and equitable way that isn't going to completely hammer the working class and the middle class? Oh, you know, maybe we need to change laws and make it so we can literally just seize the assets of the fossil fuel companies, since they've been lying for decades. Their time is up. They've been killing the planet. They've been lying about it. Sorry, we're taking that now. We're nationalizing you. We're rationing it down year by year. We're going to use less fossil fuels. We're going to direct fossil fuels to the life and death applications where we need them, like growing food, for example. And we're going to start wrapping them away from things like luxury yachts and private jets and giant SUVs. And so year on year, we're going to have a plan so that we can get to zero fossil fuels by, you know, 2030, for example, pick a date. That's what emergency mode would look like, right?
We're far from that.
We're far from that because we keep looking for world leaders, I should say, with the fossil, like take COP26, for example. Yeah. Who was literally the biggest delegate, the delegation at COP26? The fossil fuel industry, right? Mm-hmm. There are more delegates.
I mean, I didn't know that, but I believe it, unfortunately.
So, you know, it's not really a surprise that they're not only are they still being subsidized, but all of these ideas, it's quite fascinating. If you look at all of the ideas for dealing with climate change, not just from COP26, so it's a great example, but just in general, they all completely dance around this issue of ramping down the fossil fuel industry. It's all about carbon capture. It's all about reductions on methane leakage. It's all about, you know, reforestation, which is a great thing, but it's not, you know, this isn't a crisis that's being, as bad as deforestation is, the main driver of this crisis is the fossil fuel industry and burning fossil fuels, right? So you can't keep dancing around that. You eventually have to just take it straight on, right? And yeah. And
oh, you can dance around it as much as you can.
Well, we're seeing it.
We talked about it a little last 2 weeks ago, I think, the state, the agreement is like the
COP 26.
Yeah, COP 26, first one that actually mentions fossil fuels. And even then, it's very embarrassing how they phrase it. It's what phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies.
Yeah.
That's like the most defanged thing I could imagine, aside from not mentioning fossil fuels at all.
Yeah. I mean, and then, of course, you couple it with, was it the day after Biden signed that big oil deal? Like, what, the biggest?
He loves that.
And says that my hands are tied, basically. No, motherfucker, they aren't. Sorry, but
president's hands are tied. Sorry,
there's a lot of things that administration. Yeah, there's a lot they could have done to stop that. It was that was the auction of Gulf of Mexico waters, yes, right, for drilling, yeah, for additional drilling.
And I love the oil industry response. I don't know who specifically it was. I don't have it in front of me, but basically saying, well, this is the best thing for the environment, because if we don't do it, somebody else will, but at least we'll do it right. Completely glossing over the fact that like a month earlier, they'd had this massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
Also, like if you don't do it, what if nobody did? That is an option. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, it's a pattern, and the same thing with the Line 3 pipeline, you know, from the tar sands down to Wisconsin, right, through Minnesota. You know, the Biden administration could have stopped that too. The demand for expanding OPEC, right, begging basically. So, I mean, there's a real political problem if essential energy prices skyrocket, which is why I've come, you know, it sounds like maybe sort of radical thinking, quote unquote radical thinking, to say that we need to nationalize the fossil fuel industry. And that, you know, I just think it's just a travesty of all that is like moral and just in the human sphere, that these same exceedingly rich fossil fuel CEOs and lobbyists and PR people are allowed to continue to profit even while we're having heat domes and these massive flash floods and all of these projections coming from the climate science community of what we're going to be facing in the future. People dying in the global south literally right now. And yet somehow our society is still writ large, is okay with the fact that they and their investors can keep getting more and more rich as they literally continue destroying. And this is all irreversible too. That's another thing that we should probably talk about. One of the depressing things, right? A lot of this changes that are happening on the Earth system, it's not like cleaning up your local park that's got too much trash in it. You can't just easily turn things back at all, because you're talking about things like ice sheets melting away. Well, even if you did manage to cool the planet, it's going to take thousands and thousands of years for that ice sheet to come back. Same thing with the Amazon rainforest, same thing with species extinctions. And then, you know, we can get to this a little bit too, but it's not so easy to just suck that carbon out of the atmosphere. The whole reason it's going into the atmosphere in the first place is because it's so delectable for our species economically to pull that out of the ground and then burn it and run our economy and create this, you know, class injustice where people who can enclose those energy sources, right, and are still doing it. So that's why I'm saying, like, maybe we should be really having this conversation. We're at such an unprecedented moment in human history that maybe we need new legal frameworks where we can say, like, oh yeah, things are really bad. You know, the plane's about to crash into the mountain, so we're grabbing the stick away from the fossil fuel industry, seizing those assets, and then you can actually start rationing and ramping down in such a way that you don't squeeze and kind of basically economically destroy the working class and the middle class, right? You need some kind of price control. You can't just make something you need to transition away from it, so eventually we don't need it. But at this moment, we need it to run everything. So you can't just squeeze the supply. You get a huge price spike, right? And guess who would make out like bandits in that case? Basically the fossil fuel cartels, right? So we haven't even started really having this conversation yet.
And I guess my question, I mean, do you think that we are anywhere near having the political will to make some of these changes? I know people like Joe Manchin, at least here in America, are certainly standing in the way of that. But, you know, like, you've been studying this for so long, and I know that you see the difference in awareness, but how far off? You can't answer that.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I realized that for the last, for actually most of this conversation, I've really been speaking as an activist, which is interesting, as opposed to climate scientists. And I just want to comment on that, because I don't know how else to respond honestly to the science that I'm seeing. It's just it's just how I, as a dad, as a citizen, as a human, that's literally the only way I feel. I mean, it's just my unmediated response to what I see happening, I guess. Like, my response is to defend my kids, to defend myself, and to defend this amazingly beautiful planet that I basically fell in love with through hiking in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains when I was young, and you know, seeing some of the beautiful places on this planet. It's so hard to predict the future. I was just thinking yesterday that, no offense, climate movement, but I was feeling a little bit like, why can't we organize better? Why is this so hard to get organized? There's so much infighting. There's so little kind of direction of funds. There's so many great activists that are just getting burnt out because they're doing all this on their own time as volunteers. And meanwhile, we're up against one of the most incredibly well-funded, well-organized adversaries in the history of the planet, which is the fossil fuel industry, but not just the fossil fuel industry. The fossil fuel industry, which has essentially captured so much of our media and so much of our political apparatus, right? Where they have ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Commission, which literally writes state legislation that legislators then can adopt. They basically just rubber stamp them, which are you know, corporate friendly, fossil fuel industry friendly. Things like ALEC's been working on things like making it much, much more punitive to be an aggressive climate activist who's doing more than just marching, right? So if you like lie down in an intersection, for example, or you know, heaven forbid, actually do damage to fossil fuel infrastructure, then you're labeled with extremely punitive labels. You can go to, I think that Insulate Britain has been facing the same kind of increasingly, I don't know what's the right word, authoritarian or
that works.
So the state is aligned with the fossil fuel industry, and they're starting to kind of like, and so I see it as kind of a race between the climate movement. Like, can we capture, essentially win over the hearts and minds of a large enough fraction of the population, get them off the sidelines in time to, because the whole idea of the fossil fuel industry, and the sort of state apparatus that it's captured is to try to, now I think they're now realizing that the climate movement might be a threat. And so they want to tamp down and dampen the movement as fast as they can and keep it sort of defanged, right? Keep it, they're afraid it might get more aggressive, I guess you could say.
Yeah, well, it's interesting to see the shift, you know, at least here in America. This is where I'm talking from our perspective and what we're seeing here, you know, the conservative right for so long, the talking point was that climate change is a hoax, right? It's not happening. Ignore them, blah, blah, blah. Global warming. Why we have so much rain, you know, but now it's different. It's shifting. Now that's not the line. Now it's not that big a deal. Yeah.
But because now, Katie, it's because now it would be like, saying it's sunny out when it's pouring rain. Like they can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
It doesn't work because everyone can feel that the planet's getting hotter and that things are changing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But it's continuing to defang is what I mean, I guess.
Yeah.
Is like now it's not like people are now it's like, well, okay, yeah, I agree it's happening, but it's fine, you know? I mean, it's the same thing
that
we're talking
like,
about
even
the
like
whole
there's
episode,
a
but
there are a few people like I think the one Republican I can think of who's like, yeah, climate change is real, we should do something about it, is like Dan Crenshaw. And even then, it's like, you're either be 100% on board with like nuclear energy and replacing everything with nuclear energy, or you're not a serious person. So like, even then, there's no like actual like interaction with or organizing with like the actual climate movement that has been saying the truth for decades and decades. Now he's on board. It's like, yeah, but like, it's got to be this. So it really just doesn't see, it seems like just like another stalling tactic.
Mm-hmm. And then the fossil fuel industry itself really wants us to think that we need to, plant more forests, or that we need to have, you know, carbon offsets, or that we need to do carbon capture from the atmosphere, right? So they actually have ads talking about these kinds of things. Why? Because they're deflections. They're distractions away from what they know needs to happen, which is literally an end to their existence.
Right. I mean, carbon capture, sure, whatever technology we can come up, great. That's a thing, a tool, perhaps. Perhaps I should let you speak to that. But to me, it's always like, no, that's just a little all of these ideas are pieces of the puzzle, but the main thing we still aren't addressing, you know?
Right, there's a centerpiece to this whole thing, and all these other ideas, those two, because they all work together, much like the climate and the planet. Everything is like very intricate, nuanced systems working with other systems. But without doing this one central thing, these other things are just essentially a distraction.
Yeah.
I would say that things like addressing methane leakage, that's a piece of the puzzle. I would actually push back and say that carbon capture is not a piece of the puzzle. It's actually a dangerous distraction.
That's what I was hoping to get to here. Well, yeah, talk to us about that.
So, you know, I tweet when the new facility in Iceland turned on like a few months ago, there were a lot of all these articles praising it. And they actually said, you know, how much carbon it could capture in a year. So I just did a little bit of arithmetic. It turns out that it amounted to a little bit less than 3 seconds worth of humanity's emissions at current rates. So what did that call? I think it came up. Yeah,
that math doesn't add up for us here.
You would need like 10 million of those things to actually take out what we're putting into the atmosphere. So it's and it's the thing is, you know, if somehow the price of doing that decreases by like a factor of 100 or something, then maybe someday it'll be viable and scalable.
When I look at billionaires spending money on other things, I'm like, well, maybe this won't work out, but wouldn't it be better if we were investing in trying to make this energy like actually viable? But maybe it's not even possible.
That's the thing. I don't think it's possible. I think there's fundamental thermodynamic limits to how efficient you can make it. And it's always going to need a certain input of energy, which means it's always going to have a certain baseline price.
So and is that true for desalinization too?
Yes, because it's a very energy intensive process. Mm-hmm. So, fuck.
Sorry.
Yeah, there is kind of an easy way out of all of this, but it's ending the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not totally sure why everyone just doesn't want to start saying that. I think it's because it's kind of a lack of imagination. But I do think, unfortunately, emergency mode does mean that we won't just be able to live exactly like we're living today. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that, again, I think it's a trade-off, and I think it's a very good trade-off, because the sense of relief, the sense of solidarity, I think you can't have a real climate emergency response while you still have billionaires and while you still have, you know, the global north making 1,000 times more per capita per year than the global south or whatever it is. There's just huge disparities, right? And when you have billionaires and when you have ultra rich people, guess what they spend that on? They spend that on basically energy. So we need to, speed is of the essence right now, because we're already seeing these climate catastrophes and we know they're going to get worse and we want to keep them to a minimum. So we don't have time to just like, if we started in the 90s, it's possible that we might have been able to completely rejigger everything, the way we do things, transition to non-fossil fuel energy, whatever your favorite non-fossil fuel energy is, and kind of keep going more or less. The one thing we might not have had in that scenario is like commercial aviation, right? Because we don't have energy dense enough energy sources to other than kerosene and waste vegetable oil, which is not enough of, to basically fly airplanes. But other than that, if we started in the 90s, we might have been able to keep things more or less how we sort of expected. And I think now, just because of consumerism, because of how powerful corporations are, they're very invested in not kind of changing these systems, and because it'd be bad for business. So for whatever the reason, I think now it's very enticing to people to the message that the techno-optimists, the eco-modernists, right, the green growth people that believe, that maybe put a little bit too much faith in human technology, which I should point out is basically essentially why we're we are now.
The technology doesn't exist without all the processes that have created the situation that we're in. That's the crux of all.
Right. Well, what I was going to say is also that it's just that's a very enticing message to the public, I think, that all we need is a little bit more technology, a little bit of carbon capture, a little bit of more wind and solar, batteries getting, and, you know, solar panels getting cheaper, batteries getting cheaper. It's a huge, that is a piece of the puzzle. That's a real piece of the puzzle. But I just don't think, again, it's a race against time, and it's a race to save as much of this beautiful fucking planet as we can still save. So we're now at this point in 2021, having procrastinated this long, thanks in large part to the fossil fuel industry, we're really behind the eight ball. And so, yeah, I think we are going to have to, especially in places like the United States, which are so rich, and even though there's big disparities even within the United States, but on a per capita basis, especially the rich Americans are burning so much fossil fuel that the global rich, let's say the top global, 10%, which probably emits like way more than half of the world's fossil fuel, they're definitely going to have to start using less energy, which means they're not going to be able to they're not going to be able to live in, split their time between New Zealand and California and fly back and forth once a week, for example. I'm just saying, because that's the opposite of climate emergency mode.
Yeah.
Right?
We need to invent some teleportation devices or something, man. We've touched on this, and I'm pretty sure I know where your answer is based on our constant coming back around to the oil industry. But, there is a lot of discussion about, personal responsibility, and what we can do. And that's stressful also because you're like, oh, I've been recycling all my life and it turns out that it's not doing anything. Okay. it's hard. And like, oh, I feel guilty for taking this flight to go travel somewhere, even though I know that someone else is going to take that seat, and there's all this personal responsibility. And then there's the conversation about meat. And so there's a lot of ways that we can take it upon ourselves to do things. And I guess I'm curious about your perceptions on that. Also, this is also probably part of what you're saying. We will not have fish soon to eat. Like, that's an example of a way that your life is definitely going to change, but we've got all these sustainable meats being grown in labs, although maybe there's an energetic footprint for that too. I don't know.
There's the vegan alternatives to meat, which are starting to get pretty darn good, actually. They haven't figured out, in my opinion, they haven't figured out how to replace
like beyond
cheese.
Burgers.
Yeah,
cheese is the biggest problem.
Cheese is hard.
Cheese doesn't vegan cheese doesn't taste good yet, in my opinion. Sorry,
it's
I probably
awful.
Just offended
it's bad.
A lot
it's
of vegans.
Bad.
But the meat substitutes are surprisingly good.
They're great.
If you're in the mood for like a greasy, nasty burger, you can actually have one. I am a vegetarian.
So did you become a vegetarian as you saw what's happening?
It was a big part of it. I've been thinking about it for a long time. Yeah. Also just because of the cruelty factor.
Yes.
And one time I was just standing in line at the Mexican food truck on the Caltech campus. And I was going to order my usual pork burrito. I'm like, why don't I just try the veggie burrito today? And it was great. And I'm like, all right, I guess I'm a vegetarian now.
It was that simple.
That. Yeah, it was that simple for me at least.
Yeah, there's great vegetarian food.
Over the next month, I tried meat a couple more times. Like I was visiting someone's house or something and they were serving meat. And I felt kind of gross afterwards. Who knows, maybe my stomach was already changing. So like those couple of experiments during that first month just confirmed it for me. I'm like, I'm good. Don't need to eat that anymore. But I do have a unique perspective on the whole personal emissions thing because in 2010, I was like just beyond freaking out about climate change. This was like an early adopter of climate freak out, I guess. And there wasn't really much of a climate movement at all. It was quite different than it is today. There was no Extinction Rebellion. There was no Greta. There was no school strikes. There was no NPR never talked about it. The New York Times barely ever talked about it. So it was just like a hidden thing. And I would talk to friends, even family members about climate change. And they would just basically, depending on how much they liked me, kind of gauged how polite they were. But they basically all thought I was a freak, I think. And so I'm like,
it's not easy being a prophet.
What can I do? So I'm like, well, you know what? I'm still burning a lot of fossil fuel. I'm flying I'm emitting about 20 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year, which is a little bit more than the current average of Americans now. And so I was just curious. I'm like, well, where's it coming from? Like, when I fly, when I drive, et cetera, how much of those different activities translate into emissions? So I was curious. And then once I started quantifying it, I started reducing it. And I liked it better. Like, because part of why I liked it better was because I was freaking out so hard about climate change. And it was at least giving me something to do. And it was sort of fascinating because I got to see, like, where are the systems that are super hard to change, right? So, you know, you can easily just stop flying. You can easily stop eating meat. A little bit harder to be vegan. Pretty easy to use almost no electricity at that time. Really hard at that time for me, really hard to stop using natural gas. So it was just really interesting to see, like, where were the limitations and how the systems, the human systems that we've made, were kind of channeling all of us into using fossil fuels. So for me, it was fascinating, and I liked it, and I liked reducing my emissions. And so that's why I decided to write the book, because I'm like, no one's saying that it's actually super fun to do this. And there's, you know, I was getting more involved with community. I started gardening. I got involved with my local transition group, which interestingly, they didn't really like the message that we have to, the climate is the big problem and we have to stop using fossil, because a lot of them were flying. So flying, interestingly, became a really contentious issue. But what I realized very quickly is that, you know, for emitting 43 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere every year as a species, if you reduce your own by 18 tons, it's depressingly small. And so I realized then, you know, that that's not going to be my main response to this. You know, I need to be an activist. I need to speak out. I actually changed my career around that time. I left astrophysics and became a climate scientist, partly, again, out of curiosity. I'm like, I'm already reading all these papers about climate change. I guess I just become, you know, make that my career. And then, you know, at least I can not feel guilty where I should be reading astrophysics papers and writing them. And instead, I'm just all interested in neuroscience. And I was sort of hoping at that time, too, that by, you know, this message that it's actually pretty fun to make these kinds of changes, that it would sort of catch on. And I grossly underestimated the fraction of humans who would be really willing to make these kinds of voluntary changes. So very quickly, I realized this is not the path. Like, expecting people to change out of the goodness of their hearts isn't going to solve this problem. It's actually really quite obvious when you think about it. That's why we all need to be out in the streets, because we need policies that kind of change these systems and ensure that, kind of make it so that everyone starts using less fossil fuel, even if they're not even really thinking about it, right?
Yeah.
Right, where it's not an actual, like, necessarily an individual choice to use less. It's just now the systems that we have make that possible.
Exactly. Or even make it impossible to use fossil fuels.
Right.
But we might have to make changes. You know, like I would say we have a great technology for doing shipping and for getting passengers across oceans, which doesn't use any fossil fuel whatsoever. And we did it for hundreds and hundreds of years and it worked great. And somehow to suggest that we actually reinstate like sailing ships, for example, you can make them all modern and you can imagine some artists making them look super futuristic, right? Which helps, I guess, makes it more palatable to people.
Yeah, people, yeah.
Get Tesla on it.
I'm committing heresy by saying that, right? Because the world's greatest religion now is basically technology and this idea that we can technology our way out of everything, which is a form of magical thinking. Like, we are a technological species, and we always have been. You know, even a violin is a great example of technology. A fire is an example of technology. Clothing is an example of technology. So it'd be foolish to say we can't live without technology, but at the same time, we have to be smart and not magic. Like, we're not going to live on Mars, people.
It's not. No.
You're never, sorry, Katie, you're never going to live on Mars.
That's okay. I'm afraid of heights. The thought of going there sounds terrible.
It's a really shitty place, actually. It's super cold. It's got all this radiation. This all this radiation that would give you cancer. There's like no food. The closest food is billions of miles away. You know, it's a terrible place. Fun place to visit, but terrible place to live.
Katie, I like the idea that you're afraid of heights, so being on Mars would feel like you're very, very high up.
Yeah. It's logically
sound. As you land, you're still like, oh my god, I'm so high up.
Oh no, I'm gonna fall. Yeah, it was a joke.
Okay, I would love to ask, what's the, like, if there was one thing that Joe Biden could, like, executive order tomorrow, even if it's not everything, like, what would it be?
Oh, what a good question. Oh, gosh. That's a great question.
Take your time. We can cut out the thinking time.
Yeah.
I would probably executive order away all fossil fuel subsidies first. Because that's still in the official Democratic national platform, like the official party platform, that they shall protect fossil fuel subsidies for the industry.
Fossil fuel subsidies.
Exactly. Think of the poor. Yeah. I love the narrative that, this plucky band of fossil fuel CEOs is going up against this this evil, conspiracy of climate scientists, you know, trying to anyway, because that one might be possible. My first instinct, Jonathan, was to say the thing that I really want to see is a moratorium on any new fossil fuels, like no new production. You know, we'd have to ramp down existing wells and, fossil fuel infrastructure, but don't start any new projects. Don't approve any new drilling permits. Don't open up the Gulf of Mexico. Don't open up the Arctic. Just like the first step to fixing this is to stop making it worse, right? I'm not sure if that would be possible with an executive order or not. Maybe a good executive order, which I think could be an executive order, would be to shut down the Line 3 pipeline. Because again, that would be extremely symbolic to basically say we are going to really start, not expanding this industry, but starting to scale back and ramp it down. The thing is, though, I do understand, you know, how tough it would be in his shoes. He has to have a way. He has to have a way to do it without making, personally, I think gas should get super expensive, but if the gas goes up to like $10 a gallon or something, there's going to be literally riots in the United States.
I mean,
so there has to be some, as we transition away from it, there has to be some way to prevent that kind of price pressure, like I said earlier, on the working class. Yeah. So it's, that makes it more complicated maybe than just an executive order.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might. I mean, there's things that Biden and Congress can push towards. And yeah, there's going to need to be a transition period. So it's less like we can turn it off. Because, right, if gas goes up, he doesn't get no Democrat ever gets elected again. If there's $10 gas, and then we can kiss the whole thing goodbye.
As a corollary, one thing that's really bugged me about his presidency is that he has refused to use the bully pulpit to elevate climate as an emergency issue for humanity. That's a no-brainer because that costs him nothing. In fact, I think if he did that, his popularity among young people would just start to take
absolutely
off.
Absolutely. I mean, so they put all that stuff in the, you know, the big bill, and then, of course, it's all the first thing to go. But he's not talking about it. He's not fighting for it. He's not pointing out that Joe Manchin works, you know,
exactly
with the oil industry, coal industry. Sorry, he's sleepy. It's a lot, but
it doesn't seem like a priority to him. Yeah, yeah. And right. Again, again, as a sort of speaking as an activist and a citizen, you know, I was, I tried to do everything I could to get Bernie to be the. To get through the primaries and to be the general election candidate.
Yeah.
Because I've spoken to him, and he understands the emergency nature. He basically says, yeah, it's going to be expensive, But what's the alternative? It's right. losing everything. It's losing the planet. So don't tell me that, you know, my $10 trillion over 10-year plan is too expensive, which I thought was that was about the right magnitude of a climate plan, what Bernie had.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he would have, I don't know, it's bygones are bygones, I guess. But I thought there's so much potential to start to create some unity among the working class. Like no more of this like red working class, blue working class. Let's just have like a party that is good for the working class and good for the planet and good for young people. And I think Bernie represented all of that common sense stuff. So yeah, I was really devastated when, you know, on that, what was like the day after, day before Super Tuesday or something, when Obama made the phone call.
Yeah, Super Tuesday.
I just got this sinking feeling in my stomach, and I was waiting to see what Elizabeth Warren would do because she was sort of his last chance. And I'm like, come on, for the planet, Elizabeth, please, please. And it didn't happen. And it just seemed like everyone was out for their own kind of career self-interest. And it was just, I really felt like that moment was going to be something, if there's still history in 2050, that would be a really pivotal moment when, you know, people could have had this president who was really prepared to do everything he possibly could about the climate emergency.
I mean, so, same in 2016, you know?
And somebody who does seem to be like one of the few people who understands the power of the bully pulpit and was prepared to use it about these kinds of issues. It seemed to me that
I'll
go out and I'll talk about it all the time because you know.
It's a sort of antidote to the sort of weak media messaging and the disinformation from the fossil fuel industry, right? That to have a president basically saying this is like with the, you know, the space race, right? This is humanity's moment. We've never faced a moment like this in our entire history. This is the only planet in the universe known to have life, and we're in this extinction crisis. We're you know, the planet's overheating. If we get to 2 degrees Celsius, which we're going up 0.1 degrees Celsius every 5 years, it's insane how fast it's going up. But if we get, you know, if we get to 2 degrees, it could be far worse than anyone predicts. You know, I'm not sure that 2 degrees is can actually, if that's a global climate that can support 8+ billion humans with all the agriculture and water systems that goes along with that. So yeah, that we need a president saying stuff like that. Like, this is the moment we could deal with this gross inequality, right? This is, it's worse. Inequality is worse than it was when we had the robber barons. We need policies to do something about all of this. We even need to go one step further and look at the way we do economics, right? Which is right now predicated on growing 3% per year forever, which means that every, 30 years or so, 25 years, it had doubles, right? The size of the whole economy doubles, which is why 30 years ago, we were literally emitting half as much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere as we are today. Right. So,
but it's exponential.
It's exponential. That's the way it works. So the doubling time is about 30 years because it's about 2% per year growth in our carbon emissions, which is pretty close to the economic growth, right? Actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a doubling time of 30 years, which means over the last 30 years, humanity has, when the COP started, right? When the United Nations talk started, we've emitted as much CO2 as the whole rest of humanity up to that point did. Right. And so we can't afford to keep doubling like that. If we double again between now and 2050, we're cooked. Right. So we have to ramp it down super fast. You know, like I said in that op-ed, there's only two problems with net zero by 2050. One of them is net zero and the other one is by 2050.
By 2050, I know. When people talk about these far off things, I'm like, what are we doing?
What politician? About?
We'll be in a different world by then. We'll be living in flames.
Come on. I don't even take a deadline at the end of the week seriously, let alone something by 2050. Yeah.
But like, just to highlight the point that you make in that, and in case people haven't seen it, it's when you put a deadline so far away, it removes all sense of urgency.
That's exactly right. Especially
and
when you
we
have
need the urgency.
Especially when you have 4-year political terms, and you're yeah. that allows you to be a lot more concerned about gas prices than you are about the fate of
right,
the planet.
Right.
So.
Oof.
COP27. COP27 is going to figure
COP20,
it out.
We're really going to come back around. I mean, we've been talking for an hour straight here, so we should wrap it up. But this is.
I really hope this is the year. I really hope this is the year that we switch to climate emergency mode, which is why I was trying to push back against the narrative that COP26 was a success, because I think it was an abject failure. Mm-hmm. The metric for success is whether world leaders are willing to take on the fossil fuel industry and ramp it down rapidly. Whether they're willing to treat this like an emergency. If they're not willing to treat this like an emergency, it was a failure. It's as simple as that. And until we recognize that it's a failure and that maybe world leaders aren't going to voluntarily save the planet for us, until we recognize that, I don't think as a society, as a movement, we're going to do the things we need to do to force them, either replace them or else force them to make the changes that we need for a habitable planet and a beautiful future with solidarity and, you know, coral reefs and sequoias and a sense that, you know, our kids are going to, things are going to be better for our kids. Like, wouldn't it be lovely to have that? That's what I want to feel that before I die. That's my goal. Yeah. That's my one goal in life now.
I think that's
a
pretty good
life. Yeah, all the beautiful
mission.
Things that took millions and millions and millions of years to be created and grow.
And we've destroyed in such a short span of time, relatively speaking. I mean, this whole conversation, I just keep thinking about how in all of the disaster movies or the alien invasion, the world unites. And this classic story that we have, especially of American resilience, of we band together when the going gets tough.
Yeah.
But this is unprecedented. And nobody sees this as the real enemy, as the real thing.
The thing that's depressing isn't the climate disaster and the climate breakdown per se. It's the fact that the people in charge aren't doing anything about it.
Yeah.
That's what's depressing. And the fact that
we all know about it.
And we're still heading towards that cliff anyway. That's the thing that's truly depressing to me.
Yeah.
We almost ended on a non-depressing note.
I know we did. But you know what? Oh. But again, this is good and honest and true. And this is what people need to know.
I feel less depressed now than at the start of our conversation.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, you've answered a lot of my questions. Cody, you had something.
I was going to try to move it to something that's less depressing and even less climate related. Just knowing you used to be an astrophysicist, I am curious. This is a silly question. I think space is amazing. I've always loved it. I think people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos have ruined space and made it seem a lot. Just it's a bummer to me. What's your favorite cosmic phenomenon or moon or star?
Oh,
like
cute
what's
question.
The most fascinating thing in space to you?
This object called a magnetar, which is an extremely rare ultramagnetic neutron star. So it's a star that, you know, stars can collapse after they run out of their nuclear fuel into neutron stars. If they're spinning especially quickly, the magnetic field can kind of wrap around in a really complicated way that I honestly don't fully understand and become an extremely, extremely magnetic neutron star. So magnetic. So they're super cool. The crust breaks every now and then, which causes them to emit huge bursts of gamma ray radiation. And I used to study them when I was a gravitational wave astrophysicist, because I was sort of I'm an optimist naturally, because I was hoping that, you know, they would ring like a bell the same way every time, so that you could like increase the signal to noise ratio, because they'll make these bursts over and over again. So you could get the gravitational wave for those bursts, and the timing is very precise, and put the gravitational waves data on top of it, you know, stack it up and maybe see a, you know. So yeah, I was hoping to.
Cool.
Anyway,
but you didn't.
Pretty
quite,
cool.
But I had the
planet was burning, so I felt I can't
exactly,
keep
right, exactly.
can't
you got
keep doing this.
Pivot.
I gotta become a climate scientist.
You got time
looked outside
to come
in
back
January, and it was 80 degrees. So you had
yeah.
to
oh, I know. I meant to bring that. You tweeted today. We don't talk about what is it? We should talk about winter heat waves more. And we've talked about so many other things. But I'm like, yeah, man, it's been 80 all week here in LA.
It's been kind of insane in LA, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been insane.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been such a pleasure. Can you tell our audience where they can find you online?
So I'm on Twitter at ClimateHuman, and I also have a website, which is peterkalmus.net. And had a lovely time. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys. We'll be back next week. And remember, we love you very much.
Very much.